This is from The Pathway to Joy by Papa Ram Dass. It's a little collection of sayings of his. This is entitled The Foundation. Purity of the mind is the foundation on which the spiritual structure can be built. Purity consists in freeing our minds of all low and animal desires. Lust, greed, and wrath must completely disappear from our minds. Chanting the divine name with faith and devotion helps achieve purity by arresting dissimilar thought currents, filling the mind with his remembrance, and ultimately enabling us to surrender to his will in all aspects. And from Power of the Name. Namsmaran, or the repeating of God's name, is capable of granting the universal vision. The name is the link between the devotee and God who is in every heart. The divine name is a powerful boat which takes man across the whirlpools of life to the haven of his eternal and spiritual nature. It transforms man from the human to the divine. The name can bring light where there is darkness, love where there is hate, order where there is chaos, and happiness where there is misery. Earlier this week, Larry got back from Anandashram and he brought with him a letter addressed to me from Swami Muktananda, dated 16th November 2007. Blessed Atman, by taking the name, your heart becomes pure, and you serve those who are in distress without expecting anything in return. That is Guru Seva from Swami Ram Dass. Your loving greetings on the occasion of Pujya Swamiji's birthday, sent through Larry and Kate, has been received. Pujya Swamiji's birthday was celebrated with the usual 36-hour Akhanda Ramnam. A number of devotees from different places had come, and everyone felt great joy in seeing Swamiji in high spirits. Swamiji came out and gave darshan to the devotees several times. He plans to visit Wayanad for a couple of months from the 28th of this month. Trust this finds all of you in good health and cheer. Everything is going on well here by the abundant grace of beloved Papa and Mataji. We pray for beloved Papa Mataji's blessings on you, Carla, and all others there for good health and speedy spiritual progress, culminating in becoming one with the eternal reality. Deepest love and best wishes, ever yourself, Swami Muktananda. I wanted to speak for a few minutes around the idea of going on pilgrimage, and then Larry will give some talk, also showing some pictures from Anandashram. First of all, I wanted to say, because several of you have written to me by email, that my mother has been in your prayers and that she went through a procedure earlier this week in which her heart was examined and one of her main arteries was cleaned out to the heart. Another one is still blocked that can only be cleared out through an operation, which she's thinking that she will not have at this point, but she feels quite a bit better. She has good flow through that one artery that is actually helping the other blocked artery in its functioning as well. And so she's feeling very good about having the procedure. She's feeling better. She's not having angina pain. And the nitroglycerin patches are keeping her blood pressure down to normal. So I want to thank you all for keeping her in your prayers. My father is also, he was there at the hospital seeing to my mother, and he had a fever of 103 and became delirious, and he ended up in the hospital himself. So he's still having a difficult time of it. So if you can keep him in your prayers, that will be much appreciated. Praying for individuals is something that is a great privilege for us to do. God expresses his compassion through us. Many times we think of the omnipotent, omnipresent, omniscient consciousness that God is as something that is separate from us. And we think to ourselves, well, what can I do? Or what would I know to do? And certainly in a human sense, we wouldn't know what to do or how to do many things or what is even for the highest good of an individual. In the beginning, when we think about praying, we start out with the idea that we are petitioning God to do something and to bless a certain person or a situation. As we progress in our spiritual realization, we come to the point where we begin to think that and feel that it is God's power that is flowing through us. We feel that when we do the healing ohms and we concentrate on the names of particular people, on those people's particular situations, and we feel a current of healing vibration flowing through us. As we progress even higher, we feel ourselves lifted up into divine communion with God. When we are in that feeling of oneness and connection with God, and any particular person or situation comes to our mind, we feel an immediate blessing on that person or that situation. When our oneness with God becomes so complete, there is no I and thou. There is no separation either between ourselves and God or ourselves and any particular person. Spiritual blessings come then through the mere thought of having that individual within the consciousness. And there is a powerful spiritual vibration that comes about as a result. There are times when God feels sad or has compassion through our consciousness and our being for particular situations or particular people. And when we focus our mind on those individuals, on those situations, we know that a spiritual vibration and upliftment comes about through that. No longer are we thinking of petitioning God to bless a certain situation. We just know that that situation has been blessed. And we see the results of that. Things change. Conditions improve. But we must remember one thing. Individuals are endowed with free will. When we focus upon another individual in prayer and we're asking for a certain resolution to occur, we must know that that individual can reject that grace if they choose to. There are people for a variety of reasons choose to distance themselves from the divine consciousness. And I find in most cases that people are angry with God. They feel hurt and distrustful as a result of the things that have occurred to them during their lifetimes. And so they have built a wall between themselves and the divine. This is a great tragedy. But if an individual is intent upon erecting that wall and keeping it erected, then we must know that their will triumph. But when you focus on them and think of the light awakening with them, it strengthens the light within that individual, they still have a choice. But they also see it more and more as a choice. And when the time is ripe, they can open themselves to divine consciousness. We all have that free will. And if we were not to some extent of mixed character, mixed intention, we would no longer have any separation between ourselves and God. Sri Yukteswar once said that man endowed with free will, if he were to employ the entirety of his mind toward his oneness with God, he would have it right now. However, most of us are not singular in our surrender, and even when we may think so to ourselves or we may say so to others, that all we want is our God realization, nevertheless, hidden within the wells of the subconscious mind are the polluted waters, and we hug those things to us. And we can be of mixed minds. Part of us can want God with everything inside of us, but other parts of us reject that and push it away. And so this purity of mind that Papa wrote about here, in which everything else is erased, and we have only the light, only God, only love for God, within our hearts, within our minds, within our souls, that is the result, that kind of love, is the result of our spiritual practice. So every day we have to make renewed efforts. And the analogy was given to me once by God about how a boat, a motorboat, can be going along in the water. And if it's the kind of design of a boat that planes upon the water, when it's going on a low speed, it's not yet planing, it's trudging through the water, it's hard work, there's a lot more surface to push against. But when a particular speed is reached, suddenly that boat pops up, and now it's called planing on the water. It's skimming along the surface. There's much less friction, there's much less surface for that hull to have to fight against in terms of its contact with the water. The boat is you. It's yourself. The water is your consciousness. And in particular, what's underneath the surface is your subconscious mind. And when your subconscious mind is very much at variance and against you, going towards God for various reasons, it's really trudging through the mud. It's difficult. It takes a lot of energy, a lot of power to keep you going. But if you persevere and you continue to employ your spiritual practices, you will suddenly one day pop up on the surface, and it may just happen for a few moments, but suddenly you're planing upon the water. It's much easier. You can't believe how easy it is. You're skimming along the surface. There's hardly anything that keeps you back. But perhaps you get careless, or there's some subconscious prompting that occurs. Suddenly you find yourself losing power again, and you sink back down underneath the surface of the water. And now you're plowing again. And you think, why in the world did this happen? I was doing so well. Life was so easy. Everything seemed so self-evident. Now, suddenly, I'm confronted with everything dark. Everything of the ego. It's not so easy anymore. And perhaps you think you've fallen off the path. But this is merely the result of having purified your mind so much, which allowed you to plane for a while, perhaps just even grace that has come from God and Guru. And now you're plowing again. And now it's time to work some more. And so you do more practice. You do more work. And you have another experience again of popping up. Now some people give up at that point. They think they are ensnared by the ego. And there's no hope. They get totally bogged down. And so they think it's easier not to struggle than to have to struggle and do their spiritual practice, so they leave it. Little do they know how difficult their lives will be because they do that. They think they're taking the easier way, and in the beginning it is. But then the price begins to accumulate more and more and more. There is nowhere else to go. There's nothing else for you to do but to engage in your spiritual practice. And when the intensity of purpose comes along in a very great way, then you will pop up and you will plane on that surface and you will keep going and you will guard that so carefully that nothing will bring you down. The consciousness is then purified. And you are able to stay in that communion, in that union with the divine consciousness. You become a blessing not only for yourself, but for the world around you. And this is a wonderful, wonderful thing. We are entering into what is thought of as the Christmas season. And it's placed at this time of year for a very specific reason, and that is because of the winter solstice. And it is at the time when the Earth, the northern hemisphere, is furthest away from the sun, and so our nights are longer and our days are shorter. And at the time when we are in our rotation around the sun, we are about to enter into a new phase in which the days will become longer and the nights shorter. And so symbolically, this is the time of a new year, of a new birth, a new life. Now, there's nothing that says that the birth of Christ within you needs to come at this time, other than astrologically we know from Sri Yukteswar that there are particular times of the day and particular times of the year that are like openings. The vibration, the cosmos themselves, seems to cooperate with deepened meditation. Now, for myself, what I have noticed is that the build-up time to the winter solstice is always a very difficult time, something that is packed with experiences. It is a dredging up of the darkness within the subconscious mind. And this is for the purpose of purification. And then when the solstice actually comes, something shifts. And I noticed that for many years. And then it shifted, and then everything became easier. It's like daylight suddenly came out onto the consciousness. And now I understood the presence and the divine connection within myself. And it became apparent to me where before it was just very, very difficult going. And so these things are real. They have a true influence on us. Now, ultimately, as we rise up into divine consciousness, those things of the world, those astrological influences, have less and less influence on us because what has more influence is the divine consciousness. So astrological influences are not supreme, nor should they be given extraordinary powers within our lives. However, we must acknowledge that they do have an influence on ourselves and on others around us. And it helps to explain why certain things happen at the time that it does and in the way that it does. But always and forever, God is the supreme power within you. Master used to ask people, different astrologers, to tell him when his worst times were, when things were most difficult for him astrologically. And then he would set out, based on the power of God within him, to accomplish what he wanted to do. And at those times, Master would say that the obstacles that he would come up against were extraordinary at the time, because the stars were aligned against him. But With the power of God within him, he would overcome these obstacles. And he would prove to himself and to others time and again the power of God over the power of the stars. So we should not see them as a sentence just waiting to happen, but rather it is a challenge to us as individuals to overcome those things when there are things that have to be overcome, because there are positive benefits as well as those great challenges that are thrown down before us. Everything that happens in this life is for our development and for our spiritual progress when we see it in this way. So even when difficult things happen, even when those obstacles happen, don't see it as something that is blocking your way and then turn away from God. Rather, turn your mind on God with greater intensity. Say, God, I know that I have to do this. You have directed me to do it. Give me the power to overcome. Give me the power to fulfill your will. I remember Mother talking about an experience that she had when she was fighting against astral forces. And she had a particular dress. And this dress, one day, she looked in the closet. She hadn't worn it for some time. And she noticed that it was torn. She thought, well, that was strange. She hadn't worn it. When she had put it away, it was perfectly fine. And she got it out and she mended it. And when she put it back, and the next time she looked in the closet, that dress was torn again. And she thought, well, this is very strange. So she took out her needle and thread. She sat down and she began to sew again. And as she was sewing on one end, it was ripping out on the other end. These astral forces were doing this. And she said, with great determination and great will, I don't know who you are, but if it takes me from now till eternity, I will sew this up. And then as she continued sewing, it broke the power of that lower astral force. And she was able to sew it up, mend it, and then it stayed mended. So she didn't turn away in fear. She didn't acquiesce to some lower force, but she called upon the power of God within her to overcome. And so this is how we should encounter these obstacles when we come up against them. Now, pilgrimage is filled with obstacles. The very definition of a pilgrimage is going through some difficult time in order to finally come to the point of realization. You see, it's a physical representation of what we go through inwardly. And there are those who have gone to Anandashram or other places of pilgrimage and been surprised at how difficult the journey has been. We know from Mother's own experiences that when she went to see Papa, that she had known that she had come to a very high degree of realization. She was already attained the Nirvikalpa Samadhi state. But she was not completely established in the Sabbakalpa state, or Sahaja, rather, excuse me, the Sahaja state of always being one with God. And when she came to Anandashram, she was, I think, imagining perhaps having to go through a few experiences, but basically Papa bring her into that Sahaja state. She had no idea at that time what a tremendous experience she would have to go through, that the mystical crucifixion yet awaited for her. Now this happened to Mother because she had come for us all. It was not her own individual karma. So what she went through and the way that she went through it was much more extreme than what any of us would have to go through. Because, as I say, it wasn't just her own individual karma. That she had already resolved before she had even taken birth. But she had come in order to lift this world up, and all of us as disciples. And the things that she went through were universal in nature. She had also come to pay a price to show what the true Christian scriptures were really all about. Because for so many thousands of years, the Christian scriptures have been relegated to a historical text about an individual who lived 2,000 years ago. And it completely missed the true import of what the scriptures were really saying. The truth behind the scriptures was that it is the description of what every individual goes through in their ascent from the human to the divine, that is, from human ego consciousness into the divine supreme consciousness of God. It's a roadmap, it's a blueprint. And it's so wonderfully constructed because it says in detail, but you have to understand, you have to have a legend for the map in order to really comprehend it. And that legend had been long ago lost. We came through the Kali Yuga, and on the Kali Yuga, things were reduced down to material form. So a church was thought of to be a building rather than the consciousness of the individual. New Jerusalem was thought to be a city instead of the new consciousness of the Sahasrara, the crown chakra of your head. Christ was thought to be an individual who lived and breathed, and truly there was a great spiritual master named Jesus. But the symbology runs deeper than that. It is a pure divine consciousness that is within you, within every one of us. And it is a clarion call to all humanity to rise up to that divine consciousness, not just simply to accept by faith that an individual lived 2,000 years ago who was an avatar, who was a son of God, a supreme being, but rather even something closer. That supreme consciousness resides right within you. This is the truth behind the scriptures. And Mother came to bring that truth to humanity. Now, there have been those who have brought different aspects, and Mother brought her own that are some unique to her, but she brought the whole package. And she went through those experiences, and they were a terrible price for her to pay. And we don't see the results of that price necessarily in terms of her teaching spreading all over this world. But one day, it will have a tremendous impact on many, many, and there will be those all over the world who will see what her teachings are as universal, as true, as self-evident. There will come a time in the future when consciousness has evolved to such an extent that they will look back on this time and this era and the beliefs of this time that are common and wonder how it is that people could believe in the way that they do. But that time has not arrived for the vast majority of world consciousness. There are still things to be worked out. And so we continue on with our own individual path, inspired by Mother, inspired by the Guru lineage, inspired by the great masters all over this world of every religion, of every place, of every clime. And it's a wonderful path that we travel. It's the most direct path. It is chanting God's name. It is meditating deeply on God. It is doing Kriya with deepened appreciation within the spine and the brain as it awakens and magnetizes the spine and the brain in a positive spiritual way. We have been given these wonderful techniques, but they are useless if they are not employed. And if they are not employed with sincerity, with an ever-increasing ardor to attain to divine consciousness. Now, one of the ways that we can really quicken our progress is to take pilgrimage. And why is this? Because we go to places and we see individuals who are lifted up in divine consciousness, places that are charged with divine consciousness. And that charged vibration that has been brought about through those who have realization become places. They're like nuclear reactors. They are these spiritual atoms that are bouncing off of each other and splitting each other off and awakening divine consciousness. They're breaking down the human consciousness, and they awaken divine consciousness. Now, you have to be properly prepared in some ways in order to take real advantage, but there are those, and there are many, who come to Anandashram, for instance, and they don't come with any particular spiritual bent. They come because it's an interesting place or somebody recommended this place to them. And I've talked to these individuals. And they come to Anandashram and something deep inside of them awakens. And it begins to change their consciousness. And they don't understand it. They don't realize the old is dissolving and the new is being born. And it throws them into a quandary to some extent, because it's so different than anything that they've had before. It disturbs them. But it is a kind of disturbance that is good in a spiritual way, even though it's difficult in a human sense. And when you allow yourself to be disturbed in this way, your old human consciousness begins to dissolve. And you have to go on in faith. You have to go on in trust, because you don't know what will come about as a result. And this is true for any spiritual aspirant. You don't know for sure what you're going to evolve into. You only know that you're being guided and prompted along a path that is definitely and powerfully changing you. And so it is how God leads you. Now, not everybody needs to go on pilgrimage to a particular place, because God is existing right inside of you. And as a result of that, when you employ your spiritual practice, you are entering into the cave of your own consciousness. You are entering into the Himalayas of your own consciousness. You are entering into the Anandashram of your own consciousness. And that transformative power exists right where you're at. The grace of God and Gurus is right with you. So you go if you're prompted to, but if you feel no inward prompting, there's nothing necessary about it in that sense. And we can get some of that spirit, we can get some of that feeling from those who have been. We feel that. But also just putting your mind on God, putting your mind on those sacred spots, and you get a blessing. Even now. Even now. And sometimes when those individuals who have had a terrifically difficult time at a pilgrimage spot, when they come away from it, somehow the appreciation begins to grow, because they know the spiritual transformation that was begun at the ashram or at a pilgrimage spot. And it continues with them and it deepens with them. Do not think that just tasting a little bit of God's ocean, that you have attained everything. Drink deeply of that ocean. Dive into it. Submerge yourself. Surrender yourself to it. Do not be satisfied with just a little. Be greedy for God. Want it all. Become so saturated with that divine consciousness that there is nothing left except for that. And you will enter into that divine consciousness, you will prove what is truly living inside of you, has always been living inside of you. You will have entered into the ultimate pilgrimage spot. You will have entered into, and you will remain with, Anandashram, the abode of bliss. For that is with you always now. So no idea that I would say all of that. I was just going to turn things over to Larry. So, Larry, if you would like to come up, I don't know how you want to arrange this, but perhaps show some slides and talk a little bit about.
Thank you. Yeah, it's nice to be back. Although the jet lag has been just really bad this time. Coming back wasn't so bad over there. That's probably good enough. I don't know if you need that close to that. Okay. Well, Kate and I spent 3 weeks at the Anandashram, and Kate is still going to be spending a couple more weeks there yet. She'll be back on the 10th, actually, here in Seattle. And it's a funny thing. It was almost 4 years ago that I was there, 3.5 years ago, and a lot has changed. The Swamiji's had heart problems, and when we were there last time, I was there with Peter, and we had daily communication and talks with Swamiji. He was able to walk, although didn't go down to the Goshala too often. He would do so. And he's having some angina pain. Now, being there this time, and I know he's improved greatly from what we've heard at the lowest point. Thank you. We cannot communicate with him at all. He doesn't. I don't know why they don't have an earpiece for him, but he can't hear very well at all. It's a fungal infection to his ear, something like that. So it's permanent damage, and maybe they haven't used hearing aids or something for some other reason. I didn't ask. I should have, but I don't know why they didn't.
He's had hearing aids in the past. Mm-hmm.
So everything that you do want to say to him has to be transferred or transmitted to one of his helpers. There's a new young man there named Manju. His name is Ishwar. He has a family name and a name that he uses in school. And Ishwar is the name he prefers. So he will say several times in the Swamiji's ear what someone is saying to him. And Swamiji has to be 3 or 4 times before he gets it. Raj Gopal is there too now. He's back and doing seva for Swamiji. And there's a great connection there. You can tell he's just very comfortable with Raj Gopal. And he's a little better, but still often has to repeat everything. So it's a tedious process. I just learned that it just wasn't necessary. It was too difficult. I was sympathetic in a sense to Swamiji, but also it just was too difficult for me. You couldn't carry on a normal conversation that we'd had before. So you just learn to withdraw and watch all the things going on around Swamiji. Even when we had time to spend time with him privately, we mostly just sat. And, of course, there's 15 people coming in anyway, so there's lots of things to watch if you want to keep your eyes open. But you could just meditate and the power of God is just as great as it was when I was there last time. That state that he's attained is tremendous, and I didn't have a sense of, you know, it being any different than last time at all inwardly. It was very, very nice to be in his presence and to see him smile. But the interesting thing was how many times we were aware of how much pain he was in. He one time, and it was really difficult on us because we hadn't seen him like this, Kate and I, was looking really bad. His eyes were drooping, and he was in great pain, which was clearly evident. So he would talk with us just a couple minutes, and then just Swamiji needed to have some salve put on his back. I'm not sure what's going on, maybe some bed sores or something like that on his back. And so normally we would have to go, and he said, no, they can stay. So that was nice. But at the same time, it was difficult for us to watch him because he was in such great pain. He then took his shirt off, and we all had a different reaction to this. I mean, I felt this tremendous Shakti come from his, just seeing his left shoulder. And Kate just was in tears. It was a very strong effect just being there for that. And I'm sure the people who work with him all the time don't feel this. But for us, it was such a shock to first be allowed there. And after they got through putting the salve on his back, he just decided he had to lay down. And apologetically, he said, I'm going to lie down. As he drifted over to his left and lay down, and we sat there for about a half an hour meditating while he was sleeping, and deeply sleeping. That's the first time I've ever been with him while he was sleeping. So it was a great privilege. And many mysterious things going on in the world around Swamiji and around great saints like this. The ashram has changed, I felt, inwardly considerably, although externally it seems the same. I mean, I loved the whole place. Every single place seemed to have the same light about it, the same good feeling about it, all of that. Yet there's an undercurrent from the devotees there that some of them were angry that he was not, when he was in Pune, they weren't happy with him going there at all. And, I mean, angry, I say, because some of them actually voiced that, but also just they were frustrated with the whole thing. And some other people were saying, well, whatever makes Swamiji feel better. And he did do better in Pune. The doctor, the one Ayurvedic doctor, said that the area around Kanangad is actually hard on diabetics. And he did recover and did do better in Pune. So there's some, you'll hear disputes about that, but people that I tended to trust, especially the Ayurvedic doctor, and also the, you know, objective data was Dr. Mangala, and there was a medical doctor there too. They both said that he did better in Pune, and it was very good for him to have gone. But
what is the difference between Kanangad and Pune?
The humidity, mostly, from what I know. It's actually quite a cool in Pune, too, just overall, which, you know, most of during the summertime, I imagine it's probably better for him. He's fine. It would probably be too cold. And I think that's why he came back to the ashram in November, actually. It was almost too cold there for him. So you have a detrimental effect from that. But he was ill the whole time he was in Kanangad. He only got there a few days before Kate and I got there. And he was just couple days on and a couple days we hardly saw him, and he was lying down, he was not feeling well. It was really hard to watch, and to realize that it's been going on for 3.5 years, it's really, you realize, and he's been worse. And that's the other thing about going to Pune, is everyone who you could see that some places he couldn't even lift his head, couldn't lift his arms. Now he's able to drink with both hands. He can lift, but his right hand doesn't work very well, so they try to get him to use his right hand, but his left hand does most of the things. But he can actually lift his whole arm now. He can sit right up to and straight, which is, if you've seen some of the pictures, you thought maybe he would only be in that drooping kind of form from that point on. He's sitting almost normally, and I think you'll see some photos here. You can see there, that's actually a slide that was just taken a couple days before I left on the TV screen. But anyway, to get back to the ashram, it's funny, a couple devotees who've been long-term devotees with the ashram, I was aware weren't doing too well before, are doing very well now. And I don't mean spiritually, who can judge that, but just they are happier, and no sense getting into names. And other people who were doing very well before are not doing so well right now, and it's difficult for them. Overall, the whole energy is of being upset, everyone being kind of, the stew has been stirred, and it's just transitioning to this new form with Swami Muktananda being more in control and in charge in daily life. Swamiji being only coming to the flower ceremony just a few times while we were there.
Is part of this an attachment to personality bothering these people?
Well, yeah, I'm sure. An attachment to their position at the ashram, and maybe always before having Swamiji's judgment, and now having other people, not just Swami Muktananda's, but other people's judgment. And there's like five Swamis there now. And they all have tremendous effect on the ashram. And so you can see that their central focus is broken from Swamiji. Now he can't even talk very well. And then it's being replaced with Swami Mulchananda mostly, but other elements there too. And no one's really resolved how that's going to settle out. Oh, you know, it's interesting. I don't remember who Swami Abhayananda was before, what his name was. Was it Ramdas? I forget. And then there's... No, he's a very short one. And then there's Swami Sannyasananda, who was giant before. He's wonderful. He's kind of like Sri Ram, like Swami Sudananda, and plays some of the same roles. And then Sri Krishna, who is Sri Ram's cousin, is there now, and he's also plays that role. He's not a Swami, true, but he's actually influential there, and he spends most of his time attending Swami Muktananda when I was there.
What is his name?
Sri Krishna. He was Papa's grandnephew, I think is what he is. Well,
Raul still there?
Who?
Raul.
Yeah, Raul he's probably just now heading over to Raman Ashram. Yeah, he was great fun. He was just such a light. So happy there. Really enjoying it. He just fits in perfectly. Everybody loves him. Sri Krishna especially, he's good friends. He had lunch with him almost every day. Yeah, it's nice to see him do so well. I guess that's the extent of it. It feels very different, you know. It's just a different kind of place because the focus was so much on Swamiji before. You know, my mind goes back to the times when Papa passed away and how the whole ashram was just, you know, deeply affected by this. When Mataji passed away, I'm not saying Swamiji is due to pass away at all, but he has removed himself. He's not there. He's not there by physically. He physically was in Hyderabad for quite a while. He was in Pune for quite a while. And when he's there, Nalini mentioned who's so sweet. She's just really come into her own, or she always has been. But she's so sweet when I was there this time, saying, "Well, you know, Swamiji shouldn't have to stay in the body if it's so difficult for him," because she's seen it, you know, close up for 3.5 years. And I think that's, there's a lot of the sympathy of that way, too. Either way, he's just not there anyway. So they're all dealing with that change. It's funny to think about it now that, as I said here, there's two levels. On the spiritual level, it's literally identical. Literally identical, everything. Even Swamiji is identical. But on the personal level and on the interpersonal level, it's very, very different. And it's a lot of things fell through the cracks. Things that normally went so smoothly just don't as well. And you kind of have to, as a guest there, you have to kind of ask for things or make sure that things are going to happen, which never used to happen. And then you realize how many things Swamiji was doing. No, that's a great question, but no, not really. Other than the...
You want to repeat the question?
Yeah, Carl was just saying, was there a similarity with Mother when she, in her last years... I first thought is no, nothing at all. But of course, the disturbance that occurs is there. But it's just manifesting so differently. There seems to be, you know, maybe less attention paid to Swamiji, you know, in a weird way, because people will talk amongst themselves and know he can't hear. And you probably saw that a little bit yourselves, but because of his hearing is so much worse now, I think it is different. And only when Swamiji will say, "What did someone just say?" will someone tell him what's going on. It's just such an interesting process. The whole, you can take it right down to all your members of your own family and all of the things in our own life, how we deal with change and how all of this world is nothing but change. And the illusion of stability and the illusion of sameness is just that. It's just strictly an illusion. While Swamiji was running things so well, it was just that Camelot time, you know, and you realize when it's gone that it's how different it is.